I'm Mark Purcell, and this is Cincinnati Edition. The next Barrows Conservation Lecture Series speaker, April 11th at the Cincinnati Zoo, is John Kamanga, a Maasai elder working to preserve the land of the South Rift Valley in Kenya. This morning, he's on the phone from Kenya to talk with Thane Maynard.
So, John Kamanga, it is so great to talk to you again. I haven't seen you since we were together in Kenya last August, but I look forward to you being here soon.
Sure. I'm looking forward to as well.
So my main question is about how the Maasai still are able to live right next to lions while they're raising cattle.
Well, down in the South Rift, the Maasai, because they have been living with the lions for a long time, they have been able to continue to live with the lions, you know, which, you know, are dangerous animals to their livestock. But because they have had, a history of sharing the same spaces together, the Maasai are able to move and without necessarily being able to intrude too much into the lion territory. And because of a scaring arrangement that the Maasai used to do with the lions have kept a social distance from the Maasai and his cows. So has been able to reduce the conflict so much between people, livestock, and wildlife.
And that's remarkable, but also is the Maasai ability to withstand drought. I know at times where your group ranches are, it can not rain for a whole year.
You find that the Maasai live in an area that has got a mixed ecosystem. You've got like a mountain, the areas that have got like high mountain pastures and trees. You've got areas that are riverine. So they totally control when people move to the different parts of that ecosystem, because that is essential to be able to take them from one drought to another.
And for a long, long time, I know you have been able to sort of live cooperatively and using a wide variety of things, including now trying to create some income by bringing tourists to the South Rift Valley.
Yeah, so currently what we're trying to do to add value to the areas that the Maasai will naturally not be using, you know, during the drought season, during the wet season, to then introduce an element of tourism that will not take away a lot from the pasture that the Maasai are interested in, but yet be able to bring an additional income. Because, of course, things have changed. The Maasai now require additional income to be able to take their kids to school, to be able to take, you know, their family members, you know, to hospitals, which all now require money. So therefore, it is important to introduce systems that are compatible to the Maasai way of life that will not take away from them, but will add value to that system so that they don't get into destructive means of using that environment.
Now, many tourists visit the famous national parks like Masai Mara or Amboseli, but frankly, I've been fortunate to visit those as well as where you live in the South Rift, and there's just as much game, if not more, in the arid region where you live with the Maasai.
I think that the advantage here, and which is the main difference between the conservancies that we create in the South Rift and what, you know, is typically our national parks, is that in national parks, you are trying to create spaces that are only going to be occupied by wildlife without livestock. Now, it is important to note that wildlife and livestock have got an interaction. And in that area, what we do is like, you know, the space is both for wildlife and for livestock. And that, you know, ensures ownership and the Maasai is able then to manage and, you know, get the sense of them owning even the wildlife rather than wildlife being there and the Maasai being here, because then, you know, there's this push and pull between who uses the national park or not. But in our area, I mean, it's understood that the park, which is a conservancy, belongs to us. So if we can keep our livestock from away from it, we only keep it because it's to an advantage to us. When times are bad, we're able to open. Of course, in a national park, you also realize that you're trying to create an artificial situation where you divide wildlife and livestock. Well, typically, I mean, the space is used by both, and they move about. You cannot fence away wildlife in a conservation area because wildlife will move out. They're using a larger ecosystem. So The advantage in the South Rift is that, you know, even for wildlife, they're able to access areas that are not necessarily only controlled for them. Even the areas outside the conservation area, wildlife is available, and it's moving between those two areas.
And I know a few years ago with the major drought, you had much higher survival rate of both wildlife and cattle where you are in the South Rift than they did even inside the parks.
Yeah, the in comparison, the figures were like, say, in Amboseli, which is one of the greatest national parks in Kenya, we lost up to 70, close to 80% of some species of wildlife. And livestock had to be moved all the way to the coastal region, many, many kilometers away from where the community is. But for us, we didn't. We didn't lose as much as that in terms of wildlife and also in livestock. The advantage we had there because of creation of conservancy and the controlled grazing area, but the controlled grazing area not necessarily determined by us, but by determined by the community. It's a traditional system that they have built on over time. And because of that, we were able to do better than anybody else during that drought.
Well, it's a remarkable story all the way around. I know there are many parts to the community programs, including the making of beadwork that is sometimes sold to groups. I know Cincinnati Zoo brings a group each summer, and they love to meet with the women from the community and share their stories and share their artistry.
It's interesting in the South Rift in that one of the projects that we have is a community research related program, and developing that in an area in a center where we've created a center called Lalenok, which is a Maasai word for, you know, scouting, people who go out there and scout, and mm-hmm. which was in essence what we did as part of our research. But in that community, the women were accepted to own a piece of land and to actually be beneficiaries of the business of the research center. Now, the women now are able to interact with the visitors and be able to bring a lot of their art in terms of jewelry and be able to sell to people, but in a different way because it's, you know, we connect them to the visitors so that they become more of friends rather than, you know, trade mates. Mm-hmm. And that way they're able to really sell products to people who want to buy because they have got now a relationship with them, and the products will have value for them when they go back home because they can tie it with faces.
The other thing I found remarkable is the keen interest in schooling. As you said, you have to pay school fees to have your kids go, but the schools aren't right next door. Kids travel quite a way to get to school every day.
Yeah, and unfortunately, because of the areas that we live, the infrastructure in terms of, you know, hostels, schools, have not been developed, you know, closer to people, and therefore people must move, and kids move in that area, anything up to 10, 15 kilometers one way to go to school and come back in the evening. And interestingly, children will be moving in these areas, but these are also areas that have got wildlife. So maybe in the morning as you move, you'll be passing, you know, through an area that have a lion, and, you know, you wave at it and you move, go to school and come back in the evening. That is how they have survived.
I know. I always find that remarkable. The other thing I find remarkable is you will see young people, very young people, out with a herd. They might have a herd of smaller animals like goats, or they might have, you know, their father's cattle, and yet all they have with them is a young child with a stick.
You know, the Maasai's children are inducted into taking care of their father's livestock as young as 5 years. So they start walking, and, you know, that forms part of their training. Of course, now changing a little bit because of kids who are going to school, but, you know, traditionally you will get that kid going out with the livestock as young as 5 years, and they will go with somebody who is elderly, but over time then they can be able to be handed over the mantle of going to take care of livestock herself or himself.
Well, the Cincinnati Zoo is proud to have partnered with you and with the community at Lalenok It has been great to talk with you again. Everyone's very excited about you speaking here at Cincinnati Zoo soon.
Thank you very much, Ethan. I'm all ready to come over and give some more enlightenment of the work that we're doing in the South Rift.
My guest has been John Kamanga, chairman of the group branches of the Maasai in the South Rift Valley in Kenya. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Thane Maynard.